The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
How do you demonstrate technical trustworthiness? You demonstrate it what with transparency, accountability, and independence of evaluation. How do you demonstrate corporate governance trustworthiness with transparency, accountability, and independence of evaluation, et cetera? And the same with governments in a way, though there's less accountability there. But so the three ideas are transparency. If I know what you're doing and can see what you're doing pretty darn well, that enhances my trust. It's not perfect because, of course, we all know about magicians who are completely transparent, but you still can't figure out how they palm the card. But corporations are not magicians. If they're open about their developmental processes, they're open about their governance processes, that's a plus. But all the transparency in the world without accountability is really just voyeurism.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 10th, 2022. Modern life relies on digital technology, but with that reliance comes vulnerability. How can we trust our technology? How can we be sure that it does what we expect it to do? Earlier this month, Lawfare released the results of a long-term research project on that very question. The report, prepared by the Lawfare Institute's Trusted Hardware and Software Working Group, is titled, Creating a Framework for Supply Chain Trust in Hardware and Software. On a recent Lawfare Live, I spoke with three members of the team that wrote the piece, Lawfare Editor-in-Chief Ben Wittes, Lawfare Contributing Editor Paul Rosenzweig, who served as the report's chief drafter, and Justin Sherman, a fellow at the Atlantic Council. At the end of our conversation, we also took questions from the audience. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 10th, Lawfare's research on trusting technology.
Let me start with you, Ben. Can you just tell us a little bit about how this paper came to be? It's an interesting example of collaboration between industry and the research community. So I'm very curious, how did this project start?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. This started when David Hoffman, who was then the chief privacy officer at the Intel Corporation, called me and we had a drink together. And he said, "Hey, there's this this problem that we're struggling with, which is everybody talks about these companies, generally foreign companies, in terms of that their products are not trustworthy. But what does it mean? Like, what is the actual content of trustworthiness? There are no basically agreed upon metrics. What some people mean when they say it is that there have been bugs found in X piece of software or hardware, or they have been compromised. What some people means is that I don't trust Huawei because they are from China, right? And they have ties to the Chinese government. And what some people mean by it is, hey, this company does not have decent corporate governance. There are some other reasons, like they're not transparent, right? And so, he basically posed me the challenge, like, what would Huawei have to do? Or what would, hypothetical company that you don't trust, whoever you are, have to do before you could say, okay, they've actually passed known international metrics of trustworthiness. And so we were chatting about it, and you know, he suggested that Lawfare might put together a group to study this problem. And so I hastily agreed, and the rest has been a project that we have sort of worked on over the last couple of years. It was originally supposed to be a much briefer project, but the pandemic caused it to extend over over a fair bit of time. And so I asked Paul to lead it with me, and we and Paul is the sort of the principal author of the paper itself. And we convened, I think it's a pretty incredible group of people, actually, you know, from technical computer scientists who specialize in formal methods of proving that hardware is in fact doing what we say it's going to do, to China tech specialist, Sam Sachs, to a variety of kind of legal and tech policy people like Danny Weitzner and Trey Herr. So it was a remarkable group of people who we just asked to think about what does it mean for an artifact to be worthy of our trust. And that's the genesis of the project.
And just to clarify, you know, the relationship between Intel and this project, there were some Intel folks on the task force, but the product is the product of the task force rather than any sort of official position by Intel or anyone else.
Yeah, so there were two Intel people associated with the task force. One was David himself, who I asked to be on it because the question was the question that he posed. Intel did fund the project. And then the second was a technical specialist from Intel who eventually did not sign the final report. She served on the task force, and she, I think, you know, made a variety of interesting contributions over time. She was very involved, but she did not, at the end of the day, sign the document. And the document represents the dozen or so people, 10, I don't know how many, who are listed on it. And it is it represents the views of those people. And there were a number of people associated with the task force who didn't, at the end of the day, sign the final document.
So let me turn to you, Paul, as the main drafter of this document. And obviously, I have a lot of questions about the substance of it. But before I get into that, I want to ask, you know, especially since you were the one kind of in charge of thinking about what the product would look like, what were your goals for this product, right? How are you hoping that it is used? Because on the one hand, it's a very, or there are pieces of it that are at a very high conceptual level, but there are also some very, very specific tools and techniques and considerations. So what is your, you know, what is your best case scenario for how this document goes out into the world?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. And I think you accurately characterize it. We try to both start from first principles, but then dive down to something truly practical and useful. So in my idealized world, which may or may not be realizable, we answer the question that David asked Ben 2 years ago. You know, what would it take for a company like Huawei to successfully establish a level of trustworthiness that, you know, would justify using its products, at least in less than critical domains of national defense or something like that. And my view was that if we could articulate those sorts of principles ex ante beforehand, then, you know, that would guide both, you know, decisions on using different types of products. And also, in Washington, there's always the after action inevitable blame game that comes from any failure. And at least we would be able to arm people who'd made reasonable decisions with a justification for saying, no, you know, I really did think about this. It wasn't an ad hoc judgment as simple as, you know, China bad. It was a more sophisticated judgment that contextualized the product, the corporate governance, the venue, the use case scenario that we were putting it to. All of those are relevant factors, I think. you know, early on, for example, Ben, I think it was Ben Ashley asked the group the question, would you use a pencil from North Korea? And you know, for me, the answer was yes. I think for some people, Ben was like, maybe not, but it was more, I don't know, he'd have to justify
I would use a pencil from North Korea after it was x-rayed and tested for, you know, Novichok.
Right, okay. But yeah, so that's actually a really good way of defining a trust level in a kind of silly, trivial use case scenario. But it suggests that there's an answer where there's even cases where you would use North Korean products, some products for some uses with some level of assurance. And if after all that testing, somebody still died because they had a new form of Novichok that we couldn't test for, at least you could say, no, I really thought about it a bit and it wasn't that bad a decision. So to answer your question, my ultimate goal for this project is that it actually informs people's decision-making in America, in Europe, about the trustworthiness of things that are more important than the trivial example of North Korean pencils.
And we'll follow up on that. What kind of people are you referring to? I mean, there are people in the private sector, in the government sector, in the nonprofit sector. Are the considerations for those people different? I mean, are there different... Should those people be using different checklists, or is the idea that anyone who for any reason wants to think carefully and rigorously about this issue, right, no matter what their institutional setting is or their ultimate goals, you know, why they care about trustworthiness for any particular product or service, you know, this is the thing for them?
Well, my sense is that, I mean, we haven't articulated a checklist so much as a far more detailed and nuanced set of factors and considerations that people should take into account than we are aware of having, you know, ever been articulated previously. So one of the things I really like about this is that it was both practical and also relatively new, and so thus relatively useful. My view would be that as a first level, you know, somebody like Intel could use this to inform their decision-making about whether or not to include, let's not keep beating on China, but, you know, say a product that was manufactured in Israel as a component of one of their products that they sold to consumers. And it would also be useful, I think, for government decision-makers who are engaged in decisions, not just about using tools in the government space, but also about prohibiting the use of tools in the public space. Yeah, we did one little case study that Justin was the author of about, you know, how we might apply this kind of framework to a CFIUS decision, a Committee on the Foreign Investment in the United States decision, and how it might expand the viewpoint. In fact, you know, one of my hoped for goals in the next 6 months, and Ben is probably hearing this for the first time, is to do a case study, to take this framework and actually do something. And we won't do China because that's just, you know, I had actually wanted to do Kaspersky because they had, and I actually had some discussions with them early on, because that's a company that has been making a lot of efforts in the corporate governance space to try and justify the trustworthiness of their products, notwithstanding the fact that they rose from the law and policy structure of Russia. Obviously, those discussions predated February, and that's certainly been overtaken by events, and I don't think it would be a sensible project. But I'd like to find somebody or some set of companies that we could talk about, that we could do a legitimate study of this and test drive this in a public way using public data and maybe even interviews. So if anybody's listening and wants to give Lawfare more money to fund that, that'd be great.
So let's get then into the substance of the report. And I'm going to ask you, Paul, to sort of start us off here. And then I want to also ask Justin some questions, since he was also obviously integrally involved in the writing of this. So, Paul, you know, let's just start with the basic terms. How do you define trustworthiness? And then what are the three categories, what you call the technical, organizational, and then nation state, basically, that questions of trustworthiness fall into, or maybe the three axes that you can think of trustworthiness as falling across?
Well, so the first thing we wanted to do was define what it means to trust an artifact. And, you know, in some ways, that's kind of simple. It means that the artifact does what you want it to do and doesn't do what you don't want it to do. And that's a pretty basic way of thinking about things. And of course, just to put aside something, that also implicates issues of reliability that are related to, you know, natural phenomena, accident and error, that are not related to the trustworthiness we were talking about. We were focused on trustworthiness as it relates to manipulation and human intervention on a deliberate scale, not on the non-deliberate scale. But it turns out that there's more than one way to kind of prove that trust. And so I think one of the really interesting developments was our decision to kind of parse trust into two pieces: trust that is analytic and trust that is axiomatic. So trust that is analytic is the way that, you know, some people are able to actually formally test a piece of hardware or software and demonstrate to a reasonable degree of certainty that it does not contain a flaw of the sort we were concerned about. So that sort of analytic trust is superior because it's a formal testing method, but it is much harder to do at scale. And so the other types of trust, the axiomatic types of trust, are things that the manufacturer, the supplier, the government under which the company operates can do that are indicators of trustworthiness, but are axiomatic in the sense that they don't actually prove it in any sort of formal way. And so that led to these three kind of buckets of trust. And one of the things we discovered as we began this project is that those three kind of buckets really don't talk to each other and hadn't talked to each other very much at all. And so one of the things that we wanted to do was try and pull them all together. The analytic trust is basically technical in nature, right? It asks questions like, are the methodologies that you use for manufacturing something common? What are the sources? Are you transparent in the way that you've built a piece of hardware or software? Things like that. The axiomatic pieces are more about things like corporate governance. So does the company have an independent audit function that examines the efficacy of its operations on a regular basis? Is a kind of corporate governance in kind of modern day parlance, is security at the C level, C-suite level or not of a company? And then at the governance level, at the nation state level, we try to articulate the difference between American law, for example, and Chinese law, both of which very formally protect privacy, you know, quite pointedly. I mean, Chinese law is very clear that it does protect privacy, but nobody believes it. Why? And articulating that difference, I will say one of the most interesting pieces of this for me was that our European members have a significant distrust of American law. And so articulating, you know, what the difference is, but they were more than willing to acknowledge that their distrust of American law and policy was different in kind than their distrust of Saudi Arabia or Russia. And so articulating all of that was a really interesting proposition. So that was the structure: define trust and then break it down into these two different types with three different valences, and then try and then reconstruct the whole thing together to make a blended or combined or synthesized way of trust.
So Justin, let me turn to you next. Let me start by asking, we have this distinction between analytic trust and axiomatic trust, which is, I learned a ton reading this piece, but I thought this was a particularly useful concept. How do you evaluate these different types of trust? I mean, maybe axiomatic trust you can't evaluate because that's the whole point of it being axiomatic. You either believe in it or not. But presumably analytic trust, there are some methodologies to do that. And so, you know, can we say anything general about what are the better versus worse ways to figure out if you should analytically trust something?
Axiomatic trust, as you said, because it's sort of taking things at face value, generally is a less robust trust mechanism than analytic. Right, we mentioned some examples in the report. For instance, you could say, we're going to create a security certification, right, or use a security certification for software engineers. If your company has 90% of its engineers with the certification, we can say axiomatically that, you know, your product's more likely to be secure. You can also think about the accountability mechanisms around that. If you take at face value that something's supposed to be protected, then, you know, reputational harm, et cetera, is something else to consider. But again, it's pretty weak as a basis for trust. Analytics much stronger, and so is synthesized. As Paul said, you obviously can't test everything when you're testing a product. First of all, even if you could, would be too time intensive, but you also can't because you don't know everything you should be testing for. You can basically do two categories of things. You can look at a series of possible inputs to a piece of software, then look at the outputs and use that, or you can try and look at how something is running and then deduce security properties off of that. And so again, there's lots of challenges with doing so. Some kinds of cyber attacks, like a side channel attack, you can't test through an input output. So side channel attack being, for example, data is accidentally leaked through some device process. That's not something you're going to catch if you're saying, well, plug in A and see what the output is. And so you have sort of all of these challenges associated with that. And we see this in a couple examples we mentioned where companies have tried to do this. So not to keep belaboring China, the you know, most widely known example would be the Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Center in the UK, where the UK government stood up this facility to basically get code and access to Huawei devices and to run security checks. They've had security findings come out of that, but again, there's a question of how much they're looking at, how much they can access. Microsoft did a similar thing about 2 decades ago, stood up a program to supply source code in a secure environment to governments to do security testing on Windows products. So again, it's stronger to do this kind of testing, as Paul said, than it is to take things at face value. So analytic is stronger than axiomatic, but you know, it's still not perfect. And then synthesize, just to wrap here, as Paul referenced, is really bringing all of this together and saying, okay, we can't test everything. We probably shouldn't also just take things at face value. We're looking at a device that has a bunch of different subcomponents. How do we develop trust in the components and then abstract that up to, you know, synthesize that up to having trust in the device itself?
Can I just add to that, you know, ultimately, when you're looking at an artifact, you're looking at a very complicated mix of a technical artifact, which is evaluatable as a technical artifact, a company that produced it that has its own virtues and flaws as a company, and a policy environment in which that company and its subcontractors operate. And so what we're saying is that each component of that, of those components of trust, have a kind of checklist associated with them that make that artifact more or less trustworthy. You will never get the binary, you know, the camera behind Paul's head right now is trustworthy or not. You will, or maybe that's a, is it a,
Telescope.
It's not an electronic device, but it never reduces to a binary, but it reduces to a set of evaluatable metrics that make you more or less likely to be able to trust the item.
Let me also just jump in quick and say one thing that really did strike me that was part of the discussion was that even the best analytic methods that you can come up with are in some ways axiomatic in their nature, in the sense that you have to trust the tester, right?
We call this the Volkswagen principle.
Yeah, the Volkswagen principle, which is a perfectly good example. And so even the best analytic methods, now probably, I mean, the UK's Huawei Center is probably a good example where you trust the testers.
And sorry, Paul, what is the UK Huawei Center?
In order to sell product to the UK government, Huawei set up a testing center in the UK, funded by Huawei, but operated by the British government, and purported to present to the British government, you know, the full panoply of everything that they had so that the government could basically test it to death, use analytic methods as best they could to establish the security of Huawei products. I think that the general consensus is that the results have been mixed at best, but it's an interesting effort to do the analytic side at scale in a way that is justifiable and useful.
To add just to Paul's point, one of the most recent reports did not have the bombshell, you know, some in the US would have liked, that says backdoors everywhere, right? They looked and it basically was kind of crappily written code in here. There's some problems with, like, one of the big findings actually was that security problems that were reported took way too long to patch. Like, it just, like, not having the organizational capacity to actually keep up with security. So to Paul's point, like, mixed results, and exactly to the question of how much can you test, they did find stuff. They found vulnerabilities, they found issues with process, but you could also look at that and say it's still insufficient, because were they able to go deep enough to find implants? Like, you know, it's still sort of a tricky question.
Yeah, I mean, I actually do think that Justin's point is interesting. It, on the scale of the things that we were, the way we would characterize it, I would say that the UK's latest report suggests that as a technical matter, Huawei is, you know, a B minus. And that it's made that the bigger problems they found were in its corporate governance, and that it just didn't have good systems for patching and fixing, and that they didn't really find any evidence of the governmental deep intrusion implant stuff that is at the core of what people think about. So it kind of almost poses the question, do you want to buy Huawei knowing that it's a relatively cheap product? And if that's the case, your answer may very well be yes, if your risk scenario is modest, and your concern about being a threat. I mean, I have a Huawei phone here in Costa Rica for exactly that reason.
I do wonder how much of trustworthiness analysis just ends up with a rediscovery of Hanlon's Law, which is that famous phrase that one should never attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by incompetence, because that does seem to be the main finding of the Huawei analysis. I want to get into some more case studies, because I think where the rubber really meets the road. But before I do, Paula, I do want to follow up with you, because the sort of analytical versus axiomatic framing is one way that you think through this issue, but you also have some other categories of trustworthiness principles, in particular things related to transparency, related to accountability, and related to independent evaluation that you emphasize. And I was hoping you could just explain a little bit about what you mean by each of those three and why you think they are so important as to kind of make into marquee organizational principles.
Well, the interesting thing about those was that they seem to be, for all of us, kind of chapeau ideas that recurred in each of the buckets of trust, which is to say, how do you demonstrate technical trustworthiness? You demonstrate it with transparency, accountability, and independence of evaluation. How you demonstrate corporate governance trust with transparency, accountability, independence of evaluation, et cetera. It's, and the same with governments in a way, though there's less accountability there. But so the three ideas are transparency. if I know what you're doing and can see what you're doing pretty darn well, that enhances my trust. It's not perfect because, of course, we all know about magicians who are completely transparent, but you still can't figure out how they palm the card. But, you know, corporations are not magicians. If they're open about their developmental processes, they're open about their governance processes, that's a plus. But all the transparency in the world without accountability is really just voyeurism. Looking for funsies, but you don't do anything about it, doesn't matter. So the accountability part of that is the idea that people who have problems have to be accountable for the problems they create and for fixing the problems. So that's kind of the patching thing we were just talking about with Huawei at the HESC is how they are accountable for their errors. If they have bad code, if a company has bad code and it doesn't fix it, doesn't matter. I mean, a very old example is back in the early aughties, you know, Microsoft had a huge stand down because their code was rampant with bugs and they never fixed it. So there was, you know, there was no accountability for error. And they've transitioned their corporate policy in a really pretty useful way over the last 20 years to be much more accountable for that. And then the third piece of this was the independence of this transparency and accountability mechanism. You know, lots of companies have internal checking mechanisms. Lots of governments have internal checking mechanisms. But it's much better, you know, as a general premise towards accountability to have an independent outside agent. In the corporate world, that's KPMG or an accounting firm. In the governance world, that's a inspector general. You know, the model changes generically, and we couldn't, you know, specify a particular model, but if a technical piece of gear is evaluated by an independent person, that's better than if you test it yourself and self-report the results. Doesn't mean that self-reporting is inherently bad, but it doesn't demonstrate trustworthiness as robustly as an independent evaluation.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023, and angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web, and in the process, it helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
So let's now turn to the case study that the report concludes with. And that's about Grindr, the online dating app that came under controversy after some Chinese firms made large investments in it. So Justin, can you walk us through what the concern was, how it was dealt with, and how the framework and analytic tools that you all develop in this paper can help evaluate specific case studies like Grindr or, you know, for example, the controversy that came up at the end of the Trump administration with respect to banning TikTok, which is obviously a very popular social media site that is owned by a Chinese company?
Yeah, I think, you know, the big thing, as Ben and Paul laid out at the outset, is thinking about this beyond country of ownership when we're talking about a company, and thinking about a range of technical and legal and organizational and governance criteria. So the Grindr case is that, as you said, there was a Chinese company, Beijing Kunlun Tech, that had acquired a 98% stake in Grindr. And so in 2019, CFIUS, as Paul said, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the US, initiated a review of this. The logic being, this app has all kinds of sensitive stuff on US citizens, you know, location history, sexual health information, information about people's sexual activity. This is way too sensitive to risk it getting grabbed by the Chinese government. And so after it went through this review, it reportedly asked the Chinese company to sell Grindr, which it did in 2020 back to a US owner. So a US group of venture capitalists now own the company. And so that was sort of the decision structure, was saying company owned by entity based in China, risk of data being grabbed by Beijing. What this review didn't do is actually look at the technical specifics behind this app. And the reason this matters is that there was a Norwegian government report on Grindr after it was sold back to a US company that showed it sharing all kinds of data all over the place with all these advertisers and others, including a software development kit run by Tencent, the Chinese tech giant. And so you sort of get into this scenario where, you know, CFIUS did what it's supposed to do, and CFIUS did what it could do. It looked at the direct ownership question, it said there's a risk, and it acted accordingly. But the reason this speaks to this report, and I think why this report is so important, is we can't only focus on that. Because if we're concerned about that data getting into the Chinese government's hands, we have to look at the fact that the data is still flowing to China. TikTok, it's the same thing, right? I mean, Trump's TikTok ban was a terrible decision and not even about security, right? It was about politics. But even that, right, sort of looked at the ownership question, was not as focused on technical specifics, was not as focused on organizational questions. That's not to say you can account for those things and that you should or should not change your decision, but just that you're having a less comprehensive view of the trust question.
So I want to make sure we have some great questions in the chat, and I want to make sure to get to them. But before we do, I want to ask you, Ben, one final question. And I want to sort of go back to the discussion we started off with in terms of how this came to be. And the question I want to ask is, you know, the question of hardware and software trustworthiness obviously has a demand component, right? Consumers of these products and services care a lot about whether what they're buying is trustworthy, but also has a supply component. The producers have a incentive to be able to argue that their work is trustworthy. And that's true of
and
Intel,
that their
obviously.
Competitors' work is not.
Exactly, right? And that's true of Intel, right? The kind of inspiration for this project. So, you know, as you were thinking about this and as you were coming up with this analysis, how did you make sure that this, you know, was not intentionally or, you know, accidentally just shilling for whatever Intel's own trustworthiness practices are in the marketplace?
So it's a good question, and it's not a secret that industry sometimes puts together projects like this by way of, you know, laundering points that they want to make through organizations that are, you know, more reputable than they are, and designing the project in a fashion that protects for that is important. So there were a few things we did. The first is that I, you know, put together a group of people to do it whose names spoke for themselves. The second thing is that I made sure that while Intel participated in the conversations, they actually had zero editorial control over the process or the product, and that the project would represent the views of a group of people who did not, you know, have Intel's interests at heart, although I certainly have no hostility to Intel's interests. The third thing is that I really made a point of not consulting what Intel's interests in this were at all. And I think Paul and the others really did the same. It's not actually clear to me how Intel itself would hold up against the standards that we laid out, but if the animating spirit behind their request to that we do this project was, hey, we think we will hold up well against any standards of trustworthiness that a group of experts can put together from a policy environment, from a technical standpoint, from a corporate governance standpoint. And so we actually want this work done because we will stand up well against it. That's actually fine with me. I think that's actually, if that was the animating spirit from it, then I think that that's perfectly fine for a company that thinks, gosh, we actually make much more trustworthy products than anyone else does. If this is the spirit that Intel was talking internally, and I honestly don't know, we make more trustworthy products than everyone else. We want the world to be thinking about trustworthiness. Let's sponsor some research about trustworthiness. That's an area where Intel's interests and public interests, as I conceive it, may correspond. So, you know, Intel has, of course, had its own problems with artifact failure and vulnerabilities. And so I'm not saying that was what was behind it. That all happened during the pendency of this. It is fair to say that the people from Intel who participated in this participated in a, and I think both Justin and Paul will bear me out on this, in a very on the merits way and without ever referencing, you know, what they like needed to see from a corporate point of view. So yeah, look, I think all of these things are, you're always not necessarily dancing with the devil, but dancing with somebody who might turn out to be the devil when you do a project like this. And all you can do is make sure that the people on your side, you know, are people who you trust to think about it on the merits. And I think I'm very proud of this result. And I would happily work with Intel again on the same basis, which is actually the strongest endorsement I can make of their conduct in the whole thing.
So I think we should go to Q&A. I'd like to start with Alice Lee, who has two questions, both excellent. So what would you like to ask?
So I'll start with the first one. I realized that there's no mention of open source in this document. And I was wondering if that's because you think that they should be treated like any other software production or hardware production company, and sort of company includes open source, or if you think that they have some trust issues that sort of makes them a separate category. Thanks.
I'll give a starting answer to that, Alice. I think at the highest level, we were trying to define trust irrespective of sourcing, and that was the objective. So the decision not to specifically identify open source was a semi-conscious one that reflected the fact that at least at an ex ante level, we could not say we are confident it is more or less trustworthy. My candid answer is that I think open source scores high on some levels of the trustworthiness scale that we want. It's clearly very transparent, for example, but diminished on others. For example, many open source products are not terribly accountable. You know, think of the old Heartbleed one, for example, as an exemplar of a failure to patch and a lack of or my own favorite. I used to use TrueCrypt, an open source encryption program, and they just disappeared one day. So I don't think that open source is inherently worse or better. I think properly managed with enough investment of volunteer resources, my own instinct is it could be superior because of its transparency advantages, but somebody has to take care of the accountability and some of the independence problems. Well, that's sort of my answer to you, but the meta answer is we talked about open source, and nobody was willing to make the argument that it was inherently better or that it was inherently worse on any of the scales we were talking about.
So Alice, then how about you go with your second question?
Sure. So my question is when people talk about, you know, software supply chain, often that is not a consumer or not an average consumer anyway. So how much do you think that as some consumers require these higher trust levels, how much are those effects going to kind of trickle down to other consumers who don't care about that? And how much are there going to be, do you think there might be separate markets based on trustworthiness?
I'll give you my own answer. I mean, early on, Alan asked me what I hoped for in terms of this report. And one of the things that I had thought of, but I neglected to mention just because I didn't want to talk for too long, is that we actually develop markets in trustworthiness. In the same way that we're starting to see the development of markets in privacy. For too long, products in this space have been all about ease of use. And you know, that's a good thing. I mean, I don't want to diminish ease of use. In fact, that's a high value thing that I think will probably continue to predominate for a long period of time. People value ease of use more highly than they do privacy or trustworthiness. At least at the larger scales. But I think there's minority sector markets for greater privacy. See Apple's boasting about its privacy and encryption policies. And there's going to be, or there ought to be, markets for trustworthiness. And now, to the extent that that's true, people who think that they can meet the trustworthiness tests or criteria that we've kind of articulated might be better positioned to say, hey, trust me, and trust me because A, B, C, D, and E. So I would like to see that market develop. I don't think it's very robust right now, and it is at the meta level of buy Huawei, yes, no, because it's China, yes, no, sort of thing. And I'm hoping for a more sophisticated response level.
So yeah, I would just add to that I think markets for trustworthiness are really already developing. And you can see that across a number of different, for example, if you think about Google and the degree to which it has invested in many different levels of multi-factor authentication, up to and including, you know, a kind of extreme, what it calls advanced protection, where they're basically saying to consumers, you know, you choose the level of trustworthiness, including sort of subcontracting your engineering security, your privacy security to us. That's a, you know, relatively recent set of developments. I think Facebook is paying a significant price right now for being perceived across a number of axes as not trustworthy, right? Particularly since 2016. Now, whether that perception is fair or not is a different question, but there are a lot of people who are upset by the lack of transparency of Instagram, Facebook, Twitter algorithms. And these are trustworthiness issues. And I think the market is at some level at least bifurcating, in the sense that large numbers of people are saying, I don't want to use products that I don't have some reason to believe, at least not for anything sensitive, leave aside the North Korean pencil, that I don't want to use products that are not, don't have certain indicia of trustworthiness. And I think the market really, part of the market anyway, is going in that direction. And that creates an incentive for companies that want the high value customers, particularly at the enterprise level, to think very hard about some of these things.
So I'm just the moderator here, but I think about this in my academic work as well. So I actually have a thought on this as well, which is, it's great for the market to segment out, because trust, like any other value, it has some trade-offs, right? You can make something much more trustworthy, but it's going to be more expensive. It might be less usable. That might be appropriate for some use cases. That might not be appropriate for other use cases. So we would want to see the segmentation of the market based on trust. On the other hand, a pure market mechanism is not going to be enough to get to a socially optimal outcome because of the existence of externalities. If, you know, I get hacked, that's bad for me, but I internalized that cost and I should have maybe bought a more expensive software, a more expensive hardware. But of course, if I'm carrying information on that device whose disclosure impacts other people, they're harmed through no fault of their own. And so that's why the solution, such as it will have to be some combination of market, but also non-market and regulatory incentives, it seems to me. And I mention this because this actually leads very nicely into an additional question that we've been asked, that I've been asked to read out here, which is, should our government have oversight over the private sector to make sure different technologies and apps are not an open door threat to our national security or our citizens? And just to emphasize, we're talking here about oversight rather than data access. So something like Grindr, something like the TikTok issue seems to fall under this, which again is, and I think, an example of the government trying to step in, whether rightly or wrongly, in terms of dealing with these externalities. So let me ask this question, and then let me kind of also say, I mean, maybe one way of making it more concrete is, given the track record of the government in using its authorities under CFIUS or Team Telecom or whatever else, is the government good at protecting us from these sorts of nation state threats? Let me ask you, Justin, since you know you've been thinking about this, and I can see you shaking your head a little bit.
Yeah, no. right, there's a lot of things going on here, right? CFIUS is an example where I said, as I mentioned, they have their authority, they've acted within their authority, they've done everything they can in multiple cases to address some of these trustworthy data security related issues. However, we have not filled in the other parts of the picture that other agencies or committees or whatever can tackle these other parts of the risk. all the way to the TikTok decision being an example of something that, as I said, was not about security. Trump said himself it was about getting back at China, quote unquote, for COVID. But, you know, was playing whack-a-mole, right? Was not looking and saying, what is the framework like the kind we've laid out in this report? What is the comprehensive way to understand risk across the entire supply chain, regardless of country, or looking at every country at least, and instead, you know, is playing whack-a-mole. You know, part of it, I think, is actually using a framework like this. I think the Commerce Department is working on doing that now, right, with proposed rules for what trust in foreign software acquisition looks like. You can see published online drafts of what they're thinking. And so some of it is this like technical criteria, but again, I still think there's a lack of bringing them all together, talking about the tech and the policy and the governance all at once.
So I think we have time for one last question. So let me close out our discussion with this one also from the audience. Put yourselves in the shoes of a Huawei executive, let's say. You've read this report. How do you respond to it? Do you embrace it and say, that's what we're trying to meet? You know, see, for example, our work with the UK government. Do you say this report is terrible? It's just an attempt by American companies like Intel to unfairly trash us. Do you do something else? You know, what do you do, you know, with this report?
So I think the report raises some pretty interesting questions for a company like Huawei. So I think on the technical side, you embrace the framework, which is kind of what they did in allowing the UK to do what they did. They basically said, we want to be totally transparent. We want to let you have at it. And ditto, I think, on the corporate governance side. And they subjected themselves to kind of criticism, as Justin described. And they kind of like opened up a fair bit. There is nothing they can do on the policy side short of what kind of Dubai ports world did, right? Which is ceasing to be a Chinese company. And do I think that makes them inherently less trustworthy than an exactly comparable, as Paul would say, B-minus company operating out of Belgium? Yeah, I do. And so if I were a Huawei executive, I would ask myself, what steps can I take to remediate that problem? Can I do my manufacturing in other jurisdictions? Can I operate? Should we like have an entirely new board of directors reincorporate in Ireland? Which is basically, by the way, what Dubai Ports World did. It kind of worked for them. And so I think there are like the message of a report like this. I'd be curious if Paul and Justin agree. The message of a report like this is to companies that want to be trusted operating under the laws of authoritarian countries is eventually those two things are not ultimately compatible, not in the sense that you will have zero trust, but you will have, no matter how you do it, less trust than companies that perform at the same level of technical and corporate governance sophistication and transparency and excellence, but do it from more congenial policy environments.
So I would second what Ben said, but I'd kind of mutate it a bit. If I were the Huawei executive, I would say, I'm on the right track and I'm going to change myself from a B minus to an A plus or an A on corporate governance and technical criteria, and then argue that that's enough, at least in some of the less critical use case scenarios, right? I would say, look, I've seen this. I've made myself much better. And look, I'm not trying to sell you my handsets to use inside the Pentagon. I'm not an idiot. But, you know, all of this stuff that you're saying all the time that's silly about not letting me put my stuff in your train sets, in your metro rail train sets because of concerns, you know, that's not a use case scenario that is at risk here. And so I think that I can get 70% of a market, 60% of the way to a market. And, you know, since I'm a more realistic Huawei executive, and I know that China is not going to let me reincorporate in Ireland, I'll take what I can get. And more importantly, I'll also recognize that the market isn't exclusively Western. And I will take this to Africa and I'll say, look, I've made myself an A-plus company on governance and technicality, and I'm half the frickin' price of Ericsson or, you know, or Intel or Sprint or whoever my Western competitor is. And you're not my target here, so don't sweat it. And I'll also trot out a couple of foreign ministers who will make promises that your government will pretend to believe. And, you know, so I'll capture Africa, South America, much of Asia, and Middle East, and I'll let the Europeans and Americans and the Australians have an ever increasing share of a smaller market.
Well, I think we're going to end it there. Thank you very much to Paul, Justin, and Ben for joining us. Thank you all for attending. Thank you for your questions, and we'll see you next time.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter on patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events like Lawfare Live and other content available only to our supporters. On Friday, May 13th, Benjamin Wittes will be sitting down with experts to discuss the latest Intelligence Transparency Report. What does it tell us, and what do we still not know? Please rate and review us whenever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, the aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. You can also buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.